You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning and welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. I'm David Sanger of the New York Times, here with George Perkovich, who you all know well from Carnegie. And the topic matter today is the Nuclear Posture Review, which should be out imminently from the administration. So, George, as usual, your timing is perfect. We thought what we would do today is I would just start with a conversation with George on the basics of this. And if all of you should have this Carnegie report that George has turned out, which I just read last night, and I have to tell you, and I would say this even if I wasn't sitting here next to George, is the single best thing I have read, sort of summarizing how each country is likely to react not only to the posture review, but to the overall strategy that the president is laying out. And I cover this stuff for a living and learned a lot from the report. So I commend it to you and suggest that you steal many of them for your colleagues. George, I thought I would start off before we got to the broader question of the president's agenda. I guess a year to the day since the Prague speech, right? He gave the speech a year ago. I thought I would start off just with a narrower question on the posture review, because it's the first thing we're going to see in this week, really a month of rapid fire nuclear setup. And just for those of you who are not familiar with it, there'll be the posture review, then the president's going to Prague to sign the START treaty. He returns for the Nuclear Security Summit, which will be, I guess, starts Monday night and proceeds through Tuesday, and I may bleed over into Wednesday a little bit. And then next month is the NPT review in New York, the once every five-year review of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, at which the Obama administration will have its first chance to really try to close the loopholes in the treaty. So our effort today is going to be to try to sew all of these together into one cohesive whole. But let me start with the posture review, since it is the first thing up. In an era where strategic weapons for the declared nuclear states play less and less of a role, and at a time when we are really more worried about rogue states that either don't have weapons yet but are trying to get them, or have just a few, like North Korea, why do we even care about a nuclear posture review anymore? Why are we still playing with this relic of the Cold War?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a flip answer, but I think, you know, there's a big truth in it, which is, because you have the forces. I mean, you still have thousands of nuclear weapons. You have three nuclear weapons laboratories. You've got a large infrastructure. You've got Air Force and Navy units, large commands, whose job it is to operate these forces. You've got a very large operation out in Omaha, whose job it is to plan the strategy and the targeting and so forth. And therefore, you have to both rationalize to them, explain to them why they're important, what their job is, and also give guidance to them. So it seems peculiar, and I think it's, you know, somewhat implicit in your question. I mean, if you, this happens a lot because I work on this stuff for a living. You're in a bar or you're at a wedding or someplace, you know, out in the country. And they ask what you do, and you say, well, it's pretty hard to explain. And, you know, you start talking about nuclear weapons, and then you say, but I thought, you know, we pretty much got rid of them. They say, well, no, actually, we still got thousands of them. And you take people through it, and then they just say, they're not interested, but they just say, I'm really glad you're working on that. and that's kind of it. So I think that's often how the nuclear weapons complex feels, too, including the Air Force and the guys who work on it. And so the posture review is a way every 5 years for the president and the secretary of defense to say, we're really glad you're working on this, and here's how we want you to think about it and be guided.
Well, this is great because it's also answered the deeper question, which is, what do all of us nuclear geeks talk about in bars? So there you have it. Okay, so the last posture review was January 2002. It was 3 months after 9/11. It was the first time that the Bush administration had a chance to put its stamp on this issue. They never issued another one through the rest of their administration. If you had to guess the top three or four differences between what we're going to see in coming days and what we saw in 2002, what would they be?
Well, I think the main difference will be that this posture review will state as the top objective and concern of U.S. nuclear policy the prevention of proliferation and terrorist use of nuclear weapons. That was always, well, I mean, in past posture reviews, it was kind of mentioned as important, but it was kind of like, that's what other arms of the government do, and our posture review is about deterrence and, you know, not quite war fighting, but deterrence, but it was pretty manly stuff. And proliferation would be done elsewhere. This posture review, I think, will put the proliferation counterterrorism thing right at the top, which is a very big change in terms of that. What follows from that is, you know, A, you talk about nuclear weapons a little bit differently. Because if on the one hand you're trying to dissuade other states from thinking these are things that they should want and that are sources of status, and you're also trying to delegitimate terrorist use of nuclear weapons, then you ought not to really be celebrating them yourself. And your own posture review shouldn't be really beating your national chest saying, you know, we've got these great weapons, they're fantastic, they deter everything, and better watch out, if you mess with us, you know, we'll threaten to use them. That doesn't fit so well with an agenda of nonproliferation and counterterrorism right at the top. So that's a pretty big switch. And by the way, I mean, just you made me think of it. The Bush posture review was misinterpreted in a lot of ways, but I think many people in the Bush administration would admit that they caused the misinterpretation too. In other words, they tried to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. posture in that posture review. But they wanted to do it in a very macho way. And so they invented what they called, quote, the new triad. All right? So the longtime triad meant, you know, we have an air-based, a land-based, and a sea-based nuclear posture, and that was the triad. They said, well, we have a new triad. And it was nuclear weapons were just a corner of the triad, and then they had basically an infrastructure capability and then a conventional force capability. What they were trying to say was that nuclear weapons were now basically a third of our overall deterrence posture, which is a reduction of the role of nuclear. But they were so macho about it for other reasons that no one heard it that way. And so I think this posture review, knowing, learning from that one, will try to be more consistent with the president's message. And putting nonproliferation and other things at the top is part of that. And so it'll say, yeah, we have nuclear weapons, because as the president said in Prague, as long as others have them, we're going to need them. And we're going to be good stewards for them. We're going to take care of them. But that's not the thing they're leading with.
It's interesting, because if you think about the division of the new triad, weapons, infrastructure, and then conventional weapons, and you think about what President Obama has talked about so far, which is weapons as a diminishing number, infrastructure, building up the labs, and conventional weapons, where he has sort of revived the prompt global strike conventional idea, though he has amended it in a considerable way. It's basically the same new triad. It's the old new triad.
I think there'll be differences in that he'll go significantly further in reducing the role of nuclear weapons in declaratory policy, the way of talking about it. But I think you're right about the structure. And partly that's, look, I mean, the Bush people weren't idiots. I mean, they were looking at a modern world and figuring out how to adapt it. They just trapped themselves in their own domestic imperatives and rhetoric, and so they didn't get credited with it. And similarly, you know, you the people doing the posture review and the apparatus that's there, Strategic Command, that's continuity. Secretary Gates, the professionals who work on this stuff. So there's nobody who's going to, no kind of Robespierre who comes in and says, all right, off with their heads, we're going to do it totally differently. So there will always be continuity. And I think that's right. It'll be a question of the emphasis and the overall project for which, you know, the president will say that we have nuclear weapons.
You mentioned declaratory policy, so let's turn to that for a moment. During the Bush administration, somewhat surprisingly after 9/11, there was no declaratory policy on the question of how you would deal with a country that slipped nuclear material or nuclear technology to another nation until the 2006 North Korean nuclear test. And then the president showed up the next morning and issued a declaratory policy in which he said that, I can't remember the exact wording, but it was along the lines of North Korea would be held accountable, deliberately vague phrase, if its material or technology ended up in the hands of a terrorist or another state. You then saw Secretary Gates issue pretty close to the same wording after the second North Korean nuclear test. Is that our new declaratory policy? Is it going to be different?
There's so many ways to respond to that, because I mean, I think those kinds of statements are very rarely aimed at the state ostensibly you're speaking about. In other words, that really wasn't a communication to the leader of North Korea after that test. It was a communication to the American people, to the Congress, to the Japanese, to the South. We're doing something. Don't worry. We're, you know, and we're tough, and we're defending you, and so on. Because A, if you were really serious about it, and when you're really serious about communicating with states like that, you send them private messages.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, there's no reason to actually think either the North Koreans or the Iranians, for example, believe what the U.S. says. If you really wanted to communicate to them, you'd probably do the opposite and say, oh, no, it's fine. That, you know, go ahead and transfer nuclear weapons. And then they'd say, ah, this is a trap they're setting for us. And so that kind of communication is reassurance and political. You have to do something politically. I think that any state that is a candidate to transfer these kind of weapons to others will be making, you know, it'll do those things not based on what the U.S. says would happen or not, but on a whole bunch of other factors that the U.S. understands pretty well. And that there are actual problems with those kinds of declarations. Because one of the things that the government and others try to do is to cooperate with states, all the states that have fissile materials that could go into weapons. We would like to produce a database, much like the fingerprinting database that the FBI and Interpol have, so that you could get samples of the fissile material, the highly enriched uranium or the plutonium they produce, have it all in a database, so that if a terrorist nuclear weapon goes off someplace, and in the evidence that you collect, you can match it better to the source. Well, that's hard to do, by the way, but there's a lot of work being done on it. One question is, how willing will all the states be to give you the fingerprints if they think you're going to nuke them in response, or if they think your response that you've already promised your Congress and your public is going to be this very, very military, instantaneous response, how much do they want to cooperate in providing the fingerprints? Now, a country like Japan, fine, it's an ally. They're not going to be giving nuclear weapons to terrorists. They know we're not going to bomb them. What about a country like Pakistan, which is one that we worry a lot about, has a lot of the fissile materials, is in a neighborhood where we worry that the terrorists are trying to get them? How do you set up cooperation with a country like Pakistan to give you those, basically, fingerprints? I think you have to be, you know, careful about, I mean, again, that would happen privately and so on and so forth, but I don't think you want to be going out and blustering about this because, again, the states that you would care about, Syria, Iran, North Korea, if you really want to get to them, you send the message privately.
Your mention of Pakistan takes us right to your report, and I actually thought some of the most interesting things you had to say in here about the reactions to President Obama's Prague speech were contained in the India-Pakistan section of it. You mentioned, for example, that Pakistan has opposed the fissile material cutoff treaty or even discussions that would lead up to more of that. You mentioned in here that Pakistan and India are both engaged in significantly increasing both the size and sophistication of their arsenals. So you're in a meta world right now where you've got the president saying we all have to build down, we all have to reduce our reliance. And you have two countries, both of whom we declare to be significant allies, who are going in the other direction. If you're President Obama, how do you deal with that? And what is the? How do you break that dynamic?
Well, I think that actually there's a, what I suggest at the end of this paper, and it's just a suggestion, but there's the elements actually of a grand strategy in what the president's pursuing, and neither he nor his administration have actually put it together and articulated it this way. There's the nuclear agenda, which we're talking about, and where India and Pakistan are pose arguably the hardest or the second hardest difficulties. But there's also the regional security agenda, which I'm sure the president, contrary to some of his critics, understands that you have to resolve these regional conflicts and tensions that are producing demand for nuclear weapons if you're ever going to get rid of those weapons. I think the president gets that. Well, so what's he doing? One of the big foci of the administration is the Afghanistan-Pakistan-India relationship. Now, you can't speak of them in the same sense because India, for understandable reasons, has wanted to be kept out of kind of the AFPAC formulation. But the administration has spent a lot of time and effort working on both its bilateral relationship with India, but also in reassuring Pakistan, for example, that if it moves forces away from the east, where they're deployed against India, to the west to deal with Afghanistan, that India won't take advantage of that, and that the U.S. can give Pakistan some reassurance of that.
So, well, in fact, India isn't taking advantage of that. India instead is going off with breeder reactors and on the civilian
right,
side
is,
and production.
Which is a big which is a huge problem that the Pakistanis will remind one of. So on the one hand, the administration is trying to reassure Pakistan at the level of conventional military insecurity that India won't take advantage of. On the other hand is the problem that you point out, which is that the nuclear cooperation agreement that the Bush administration initiated with India does greatly increase India's capacity to produce nuclear weapons if India chooses to. And so the Pakistanis look at that, you're right, and they say, this is why we can't agree to stop producing more material, because you guys helped the Indians get into a situation to produce a lot more. It's your fault, so therefore we're not going to stop. And so that has complicated, but I think the ultimate issue is actually less the nuclear in this case and more the conventional and subconventional competition between India and Pakistan. And the administration is trying to work on that, but it's the hardest case, I think.
It is the hardest case. And right after that comes Iran and the Middle East. You mentioned in your paper here that a core issue in the Middle East is that the Israelis, of course, still won't acknowledge their nuclear arsenal. You can't begin to discuss building down or creating a nuclear-free Middle East or any of the other words of assurance that the Arab states and Iran are either looking for or seeking to exploit, depending on your point of view, without the beginning of an acknowledgement of the Israeli force. So if you're President Obama, who himself I don't think has ever really talked about Israel's nuclear weapons, as most American officials do not, how do you deal with that?
Well, I'm like a Catholic Sunday school dropout. I've never studied the Talmud. But I can be Talmudic about these things. I actually don't think that you have to ever acknowledge. I'm not saying you shouldn't, but I don't think acknowledgement or public discussion of Israel's nuclear arsenal is necessary actually to eliminate that capability. Mm-hmm. Much in the same way that South Africa's nuclear arsenal wasn't discussed or acknowledged until after it disappeared. That you could have discussions, and I think this is more likely actually how it would happen. You can have discussions about transferring over time all the fissile material in the Middle East or the world under international safeguards without ever mentioning nuclear weapons. And then ultimately what nuclear disarmament is, or one of the things that nuclear disarmament is the taking of all plutonium and highly enriched uranium and putting it under international safeguards. So that's doable. I think, by the way, that a state could, speaking of the fissile material cutoff negotiation, which you brought up and which Pakistan resists, Israel doesn't like it either, but they could join without ever admitting having nuclear weapons, because you could basically, you would stop producing more fissile material. You would have.
They're willing to live with whatever the size
what they had,
arsenal.
Right. Right. And so you, that would be a significant non-proliferation and arms control step that states can undertake without necessarily having to say this is how many nuclear weapons we have. But I think in general, that question has always been very, very difficult for U.S. administrations who don't want to talk about it. I think that's a mistake, though it doesn't require admitting Israel's nuclear weapons. I think the mistake is not welcoming, for example, an Egyptian proposal to have an international conference on the topic, which you can formulate in various ways. But there, I mean, we've written about this here at Carnegie. I mean, there the idea would be, yeah, all the states in the region who are relevant, which includes Iran, which includes Saudi Arabia, which includes Syria, which includes Lebanon, and so on, they all have to be at that conference before it starts. And so you welcome the creation of a conference, you set up the table with all the placards, and if you say, if Iran and Saudi Arabia and Libya and all these states are prepared to sit down with Israel, and the United States and others and start engaging these issues, let's do it. Well, that's de facto recognition in a sense, which gets you, you know, significant way down the road in terms of the peace process. If the states in the region are willing to do that, why would we think that's not a good idea?
Before I open this up, let me just take you to a very interesting ending you had to your paper called The Challenge at Home. It begins for those of you who've got the paper on the bottom of page 11. And you make the point that difficult as it will be for President Obama, because very few other countries, with the exception of Britain, have sort of lined up behind his broad Prague initiative. He's got a problem here at home as well. Takes two-thirds of the Senate to ratify a treaty. He doesn't have two-thirds of the Senate. Healthcare showed you just how fragmented the whole relationship between the executive branch and the legislative branch is right now. And yet, in order to persuade the rest of the world that he is making significant progress, he's got a big lineup of things that he's got to go land and get through Senate approval. The START Treaty, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which President Clinton tried and failed to get through, Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, if you could get through all of these other objectives. And you will hear a fairly familiar complaint from many on the Hill who will say this makes America weaker at a time that the Iranians appear to be seeking weapons, the North Koreans are testing weapons, at a time that everybody's worried about proliferation in the Middle East. You would be going in the other direction, and so forth. Very easy thing to do in short sound bites on evening television or cable television. So if you are having to design a way to get this through the legislatures, get this through the Senate, what would that be? And what do you think the prospects are this year for START and CTBT, which would be the two right up on the list?
Well, I mean, and this is what I try to talk about in the piece and partly to help inform or remind people around the world who have these very high expectations of President Obama, as many here do, of basically the constitutional impediments. And it's not an excuse in a sense that what happens is when we travel, when you travel and you go and you talk to other countries and you're talking in Iran and they say, well, or Russia or something, everybody says, well, you have to understand we have domestic politics is why we can't do this. And then Americans tend to be, puff with your domestic politics, just do it. And then they come here and we say, you have to understand we've got domestic politics. We have a constitutional problem, which is the one that you identify, the Genocide Convention was invented actually at the Carnegie Endowment in 1948 and took 48 years for the Senate to ratify. It was an American
invention. You guys were on fast track.
That was quick. And the CTBT, I think there's zero chance the CTBT will be ratified in 2010, and I think the chances in 2011 are very difficult for reasons that are partly an answer to your question, which is that the president, or the administration, I should say, in order to facilitate ratification of the START Treaty, has paid a big fee to the nuclear weapons laboratories, basically, and the Department of Defense to upgrade the infrastructure of the U.S. nuclear weapons complex. And this is in the budget, and the president's talked about it, and so on. That upfront payment has been made because the administration thinks it's in the interest of the country and it's the responsible thing to do. Some of us would have said, well, it would have been better to do that in return for a vote on the CTBT. They're doing it basically at the same time as START, which puts Senator Kyle and other Republicans in the position when the CTBT comes around to say, there is nothing you can do to pay us off for this because you already paid to get START, which I think will be ratified, and I think it'll be ratified pretty easily because I would argue that the Republicans actually need an arms control treaty so that they're not opposed to all of them. They get this one. They got the big payment for it.
And this one is very much like the Moscow Treaty,
which they voted for. And so I think they've played it smartly, and they've gotten paid off very handsomely. They've been overpaid for it. They're going to get it. And then after that, they're going to say no more treaties. And then they can say in political campaigning, we're not opposed to all treaties because, look, we just ratified this one. But the next one's a bad treaty, and the next one ad infinitum will be a bad treaty. And I think the rest of the world is not going to understand this very well. And the rest of the world looks at on the CTBT, for example, and says, wait a minute. You guys did like 1,300 nuclear weapon tests. The Chinese did something like 45. And somehow you can't live with a test ban treaty, but these other guys are prepared to do it. And you're sending all this money to your weapon labs, and somehow they can't vouchsafe this. Or the argument I make is Israel has either tested zero or one time. They're for ratifying the CTBT. So how is it that they can be confident in their deterrent, and somehow we couldn't with the CTBT? I never get a good answer to that question, but you don't have to have a good answer to get 34 votes to block ratification of a treaty.
And it's not like next year he'll have more senators
than
he's got today.
Right.
Great. Well, let us open this up to questions. When you do ask a question, please tell us who you are, and please make the question a question. Let's start over here.
Hi, Mary Beth Sheridan from The Washington Post. Thank you. To return to the Nuclear Posture Review, when you said that one of the main changes will be the emphasis on the problem of proliferation, terrorists, et cetera, beyond a rhetorical change, how do you see that turning into, what practical effects will that have? Thanks.
Well, I think the rhetoric's important, and so that'll be there because, the way you talk about nuclear weapons will change and the value that you try to put into them will change. But I think the Nuclear Security Summit coming, 6 days later, is also going to reflect that strategy. In other words, that summit is about securing weapons-usable fissile materials, which is, we believe the only way terrorists would get nuclear weapons is if they could acquire that material. It's not believed they can produce it themselves. So that is an unprecedented effort to invite heads of state from 40 or more countries to address just that issue of securing fissile materials. And there's going to be money behind that, and there are going to be other programs. There have been. I mean, this has been bipartisan for years, a U.S. effort, but there's going to be more emphasis on that. That's a part of a nuclear strategy, though it's not the part that the Pentagon necessarily does or that STRATCOM does. It's the part that's not done by our nuclear weapons, which is part of the point of the overall effort, then, would be say, nuclear strategy isn't just performed by nuclear weapons. It's performed by all of these other attributes of U.S. power and government. So that's another example that I would give.
There's a, Teresa, there's a
microphone. Tasey Schaefer from CSIS. George, you just gave a zero probability of CTBT ratification in 2010. I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. And the odds for ratification after that don't look great. So what is a path forward that doesn't rely on the CTBT, since it looks to me like CTBT is going to be in roughly its present limbo for a good long time?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is, I just started a phrase saying the reality is, and then I don't know what the reality is, because I was going to say no one's tested since 1996, but that does include India and Pakistan in 98. So those were the last nuclear tests, and then North Korea in 2000. So what I was going to say before reality intruded was that we already have kind of a global moratorium, where in fact we do, if you exclude North Korea, the five NPT nuclear weapon states did agree and have agreed to have moratoria on nuclear testing. India then voluntarily put a moratorium on, and I think Pakistan has seconded that. That would be, I think, the only way that you can go forward right now anyway, is to say this is a norm, this is the acceptable practice is we don't test these things in lieu of having a formal treaty to that effect. I think that's the best you can do.
There's a mic coming around you, right behind you.
Hi, Jonathan Weissman with the Wall Street Journal. You haven't talked about the START Treaty itself, and I'd like you to just address what significance you think it has for the nuclear arsenal specifically, but also in the broader nuclear arms control agenda.
That's a good question. Let me start with the latter part. In terms of its broader significance, I think its broader significance is much greater than its narrow technical significance. The broader significance comes in several forms. One is in the U.S.-Russian relationship, it really does give traction to moving forward in a way that's anachronistic, but in many ways Russia's anachronistic. In other words, it was a great power in its in the mind of the leadership, much of the population, it still is or wants to be a great power. The real basis for it now that oil and gas prices are lower is nuclear weapons. It also has a cadre of officials and experts who invented the language of nuclear arms control, are very good at practicing it. So engaging with those people in that language is a way for Russia to feel, in a sense, better about itself, taken more seriously, which is important for the leadership, and in a positive direction, because you're dealing with legally binding instruments, not just informal agreements. I think that's good for everybody, but it also, the more you have the Russians kind of wanting to invest in legally binding agreements and instruments, and the U.S. not being the one for a number of years saying, no, we're not that interested in legally binding agreements, I think, again, a kind of a cultural normative way, that's useful. And Russians would say, Alexei Arbatov was here on this platform on Thursday saying, actually, that the new Russian military doctrine released in February actually temporizes the language regarding nuclear weapons and narrows the declared kind of use that Russia might put to nuclear weapons. And he says he attributes that to the Russian establishments seeing the change Obama was making and wanting to be part of that or to encourage that. So in that kind of broader sense, I think it's important. I think similarly in the NPT process, the process of the broader international community, this is a welcome correction and development, even if the number of weapons being cut doesn't seem that great. The idea that the U.S. and Russia are completing negotiations, agreeing to legally binding treaties, is somewhat reassuring. And in many ways, that's an overreaction to the Bush administration, in a sense of how much the rest of the world really, really didn't like the Bush administration. And I would argue, and did over those years, that a lot of that was unfair, and also a misinterpretation of some of the stuff the Bush administration was doing. But it was a fact. And so this is seen as a big correction to that unhappy time for a lot of the rest of the world. And so they say, okay, well, it's moving in a positive direction, which, by the way, is an important reason not to bring the CTBT up until you know you got the votes. In other words, it would be very, very bad for international politics and U.S. standing in the world to lose a vote on CTBT
ratification.
A second time. Yeah. So I think, and so then I think that also slows it down because you the administration is not going to do it until they think they got a big vote, which would take more time. I hope that answers your question.
Let me follow up on Jonathan's very good question, though, because there's a sense about the START Treaty that the cut was fairly modest. As we and others have written, you know, you count every bomber as one weapon when they hold six to a dozen more in the case of ours. So you might not really have to cut that much at all if you really wanted to find a way to make this a non-reduction. And yet there was a sense that it was so hard to get that the next treaty, which is the one that President Obama would really need, something that might take you down below 1,000 weapons, the Russians simply aren't going to do, given their own vulnerabilities and so forth. So tell us what we learned from this START negotiation that informs the question of what it would be to get the treaty that the president really has in mind.
Well, I suggested in this paper, I mean, and this goes to the domestic politics thing that we're talking about. I mean, I think it's very, very hard to get ratifications by the U.S. Senate for anything that requires significant change in the way that we think or act. And you can look at the healthcare system that way, or it's a very, you know, it was designed to be conservative with a small C. The START Treaty fits that bill because it doesn't require any change in thinking or acting. What I mean by that is, you, and the military will tell you don't have to change our strategy of deterrence. You don't really have to change the targeting. You don't change the triad, so you still have the bombers, the submarines, and the land-based missiles, even though people in the Air Force are saying they ought to get rid of the bombers, and we can talk more about the counting rule. But it doesn't change any of that. And then similarly, for the Russians, it doesn't require a change in the way that they think about going about deterrence. And in fact, it doesn't require them to cut stuff that they weren't going to cut already. And you're right, it was relatively hard to get for something that actually doesn't require major change in I would argue, any way. The next treaty that people allude to, the U.S. would want things that require change. For example, the Europeans would want to include Russian so-called tactical nuclear weapons. And I would argue there is no such thing as a tactical nuclear weapon anymore. I mean, they're all, you know, all nuclear weapons, if they go off, have strategic effects. But anyway, you want to include those. You want to verify warhead dismantlement. That's never been done. That would require a level of intrusiveness that the Russians have always been averse to. You would want to get reductions. You mentioned 1,000. Let's say that's the number, or 999 if you're a liberal. And you know, each digit matters. That the Russians have said anything below, you know, 1,200, if the U.S. still has missile defense that's unconstrained, we, the Russians, can't do. So from a Russian point of view, you don't get to numbers like that without then some kind of limitation on national missile defense, not theater missile defense, which is an important distinction, but protection of the continental United States. Well, we already know from the discussion in Washington with the Republicans saying very clear, if there's any limitation on missile defense, forget it. This is not going to be ratified. Well, the Russians would say to go the next step, you have to do exactly the thing that the Senate has said we will not consider. So for those reasons, as the one, as well as the ones that you mentioned, Dave, I think the next one requires big changes in thinking on both sides. You'd probably at some point want to get rid of the triad, which, you know, and then the states that have bases are going to be unhappy about losing that money, and so that becomes much more difficult. And moreover, given that this treaty, the New START treaty, if ratified, has a 10-year lifespan, you know, the likelihood is that, you know, that Russia would want to wait a bit before engaging in that kind of negotiation. And one last point that Alexei Arbatov made here, which I hadn't thought of, but it's very important, I think, is that Russia is spending what money it has on nuclear forces to modernize its strategic forces. And so at the end of the 10 years of the START treaty, almost everything they would have under that treaty would be new and modernized. So then the question is, if you've just paid for it, are you going to want to eliminate it? Now, there's one answer to that question is, okay, fine, right, you don't eliminate that, but the tactical stuff is really old, and so maybe we could focus...
And expensive to keep safe.
Right,
yeah.
And we could focus on that. But these are all things that are going to take a long time, I think, to work out.
Okay. Other questions out here? Straight back here.
Thank you. Anne Penketh from the British American Security Information Council, BASIC. George, you're talking about how difficult it is with India and Pakistan to crack that particular nut on fissile material ban. Do you think there is a case for moving this out of the Conference on Disarmament, where clearly it's blocked because of Pakistan, but with other countries hiding behind Pakistan as well?
Well, no, but I haven't thought enough about it to, you know, say it so authoritatively as I just did. But here's why. Moving anything out of the CD would produce a backlash from countries that are very attached to the CD and the UN bodies. That matters more or less. But the value of a fissile material cutoff really is derives from India, Pakistan, China, Israel, potentially. The other states producing fissile materials for nuclear weapons have already stopped. The U.S., Russia, France, the U.K. They already have a moratorium. France has already dismantled their facilities. We're not worried about that. So the countries, and China says it's stopped, but it hasn't formalized it. So the countries that are producing new material that we know of are India and Pakistan. We're worried about Iran, but that's a different discussion. So if you moving it doesn't change Pakistan's opposition, so you get nothing that you really want by moving it out, I would argue. So I don't see that it would be worth the headache. And by the way, I mean I just don't see Pakistan changing its position for a long time.
Coming to you from the other side.
Thank you. Naj Meshkati, University of Southern California. Thanks for enlightening speech. The document which we expect to come out in the near future is National Intelligence Estimate. We hear that there is an update of it. We learn it from your articles, Mr. Sanger. Could you please, George, give us a little update about interaction between the Nuclear Posture Review and National Intelligence Estimate, particularly in light of changes in Middle East, some of the new policies of U.S. vis-a-vis giving some protective umbrella to some Middle Eastern countries. Basically, the interaction of NIE and NPR. Thank you.
That's a great question, and it's one where I'm not comfortable guessing whether the NPR will address what you were alluding to. In other words, the Secretary of State at one point in the Gulf talked about maybe extending a U.S. Defense umbrella, she said. She didn't say nuclear defense umbrella, but everybody can read into that nuclear, to the smaller Gulf states. That idea has been talked about a lot. I actually think it's a bad idea to talk about it, but that's another discussion. Whether the NPR would say something about this, I don't know. I would be disappointed if it did, because I think they're smarter than that. But maybe they could. In other words, there will be language in there about reassuring allies. But do you then specify, you know, the Middle East, where we don't have those formal alliances, and you do that in a document that's about nuclear weapons as opposed to other forms of conventional extended deterrence and so on? It's something really important to look out for in the document, but I wouldn't try to guess whether they felt compelled to do it. In terms of U.S. nuclear posture and strategic necessity, I mean, I don't think anybody who works on this says, yeah, A, we would need nuclear weapons today in our planning to do any kind of operation in Iran, or B, that if we did, we should talk about it. So, but I don't think anybody thinks they do. So I think there's kind of that doesn't drive, you know, a potential Iranian nuclear capability doesn't drive U.S. nuclear doctrine or posture or anything else. So it would be a question of politically what and how you wanted to speak about it. And I hope they'll be restrained about it.
There is one area where the posture view may allude to Iran, though I doubt it would name it, which is that if, in fact, you've got it right, and they've sure you do, that deterring terrorism, counterproliferation, nonproliferation becomes the number one objective, then suddenly you're taking a declaratory policy that so far has been pretty well limited to North Korea and applying it to Iran as well. Yeah.
And I think you would find that they would be, and I hope, you know, rather artful in how they would talk about it, not too blustery,
right.
but subtly, right. Kind of putting it on.
Also, we're not likely to actually see a document out of the National Intelligence Estimate if they're just doing an update. I think they've made it pretty clear to many of us in this room that they don't plan to publish a summary of this the way the Bush administration.
Such a good time last time.
Yeah, right? It worked out so wonderfully the last time. I'm sure of my many extraordinarily skilled competitors in this room, one of them will come up with it, but I don't necessarily think that that we'll actually we'll see a published version. Other questions in the back?
Stephen Cull, PIPA. If there's a real emphasis on proliferation, doesn't that point to a putting real importance on the question of no first use and also the possibility of a Middle East nuclear-free zone? Do you anticipate these issues being dealt with?
I know that, and other people in the room know that the administration in the posture that they did consider no first use because there were people recommending it. I would be shocked if they included that, if they decided that that was a policy they wanted to make for a variety of reasons. And I think the debate on this issue is a very serious, legitimate debate that's a hard one to resolve. You know, how do you demonstrate it? How do you manifest it? How is it more than words? Anytime you have this discussion with people who lived through the Cold War, they say, right, the Soviets said they had a posture of no first use, but then when we got into all the documents and archives, it was first use all the way, so it's, you know, it's deceitful, so on and so forth. I think what they will do is creep up on it in helpful ways. I would hope, I think there's some reason to believe, for example, the statement that everybody will be looking out for is kind of the main declaratory statement of the purposes for which the U.S. has nuclear weapons. A lot of people advocated a version that said, well, the sole purpose of U.S. nuclear weapons is to deter the use of nuclear weapons by others. The rumors are that that won't be in it, but something verging on that will be there. That's part of the equation. But there's another part of the equation, which is the assurances that the U.S. makes to countries that don't have nuclear weapons. And there is some discussion that it could say that the U.S. will not threaten to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states in good standing under the NPT. So that takes away first use, even against, you know, conventional war, against a state that doesn't have nuclear weapons. So now you're in the domain of only states.
That's a big exemption for Iran, North Korea. Or
right,
others.
And then the question is the phrasing, if does it have the phrasing that says in good standing under the NPT, in which case you could argue at some point, well, Iran's not
in good standing. And North Korea,
right, exactly. Or you could even delete that phrase. You just say, we won't threaten to attack a non-nuclear weapon state under the NPT, leave it cleanly like that, and then when people like Jonathan and Mary Beth and David say, but does this include North Korea or Iran, you could say, we'll make that judgment at the time. Do we think they have nuclear weapons or not? Because they're not in the NPT or they violate it, you would have a basis. But you take those two things together, the kind of constriction of the positive context of use, and you add the assurance to non-nuclear weapon states, you're in a pretty narrow space that looks a lot like no first use. I mean, it's not quite there, but you're narrowing in on it. I think that's how they would approach that, is my guess.
Other questions?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't imagine they're going to go near that. I don't think I would do it in the posture review, but I think for the NPT and in the run-up for the NPT, as I tried to suggest here, I think it's a mistake to be so defensive about it. I think it is a reality. It is an issue that this question always comes up in the NPT, I think that. The Middle East peace process is mentioned in the resolution of 1995 at the NPT Extension Conference, which was required to get affirmation of the treaty, and that we ought to have in the nonproliferation fora discussions of the links between the peace process, regional security, and nuclear weapon capabilities, and that could include an international conference of all the states party to take all of these issues together and work on them. And why be afraid of that if you could get all the states' parties to participate? And if they don't participate or aren't willing to come, then you expose that they're not that serious about it, actually, and make that an issue. But I don't imagine the U.S. government's going to do that.
Any more? Karen?
Karen Bohan from Reuters. I have a political question for you, George. You write that Obama has not been able to mobilize his cabinet or congressional leaders to care as much about this agenda as he does. Do you think the high profile he's putting on this with the summit and the events is going to change that? Or do you think, as you write in here, that he's going to be too burdened by other concerns?
The emphasis I was trying to make there was not so much that he's burdened by other concerns, which he clearly is. It was more on that others haven't I don't quite see that changing. I mean, I'd like to. Let's take what I was referring to specifically with the Hill. Senator Kyle on the Republican side pretty much addresses this topic every day. I mean, he lives it, he breathes it. He knows details. I would argue he gets a lot wrong, but he's a very smart guy and he pays a lot of attention. There is no Democratic counterpart that wakes up every day and says, I'm going to do battle with John Kyle on this issue. I own this issue. I know all the details. It's my issue. Now, Sam Nunn used to do that in the old days, which were the old days. I mean, nuclear weapons mattered. There were lots of people who did this. Today, I would argue, notwithstanding the good efforts of Senator Kerry and others on a sporadic basis, there is a lack of real attention. And Senator Levin, who's a great guy, you know, as chairman of the Armed Services, when was the last time you heard him get out and give a big speech or talk a lot about nuclear policy? It's understandable. We've got troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. We spent like $1 trillion in Iraq and so on. The nuclear issue isn't there. It's very hard to get these ratifications that we're talking about if the only person living and breathing it is adamantly opposed and you don't have anybody who's really for it and for the president's agenda waking up and doing battle every day. I would argue the same thing happens in the cabinet. Secretary of State Clinton, she didn't campaign on this stuff. She was pretty shy about it, and all of her political career has kept kind of a cold, just to the post-Cold War kind of ambiance about it. Secretary Gates actually knows this issue very well, and I think his from what you can tell, his leanings are basically positive, but very, very careful. And clearly, I think, of a view that a world without nuclear weapons probably is a more dangerous place, which is different from the president's agenda. And then I think in the rest of the staff, it's not clear who really, really kind of gets the big picture that the president's trying to put forward. So I think it's pretty much he and the vice president are the ones who really kind of get the picture and really care about it. And it's hard to move this establishment, let alone the world, on this stuff if that's who's doing it. And that was the point of the piece. So then where are the other leaders from other major countries in the world who could pitch in and move it? And my suggestion is I haven't seen them either. And so I think it's a hard lift. I would say that the person who formally is and who does speak often on it is Undersecretary Tauscher. And I would say that notwithstanding her talents and dedication, that's not sufficient to move the U.S. Senate, the labs, the civilians in the panel. And I think one indication of this is the posture of you itself, which you guys know is months delayed. And that kind of the existing system and staff produced the earlier drafts, which evidently weren't to the president or the vice president's satisfaction, and they kept sending it back to do it again. That suggests to me that there are people who are all good, dutiful employees that basically said, we'll make it different if you tell us to make it different, but they're not kind of volunteering out of their own sense of, yeah, this is what is a good career move for me, or this is what I really believe, or this is going to help me in my next confirmation hearing, therefore I'm going to push this stuff. And it seems like it was on the president or the vice president to say, go back and do it some more. And that was, to me, an indication of this dynamic.
Right over here in the aisle.
Thank you. Many of us view that nuclear weapon-free zones are building blocks for a world free of nuclear weapons. For example, in Pelindaba Treaty, the African Nuclear Weapon-Free Zone, there's additional Protocol 3, which nuclear weapon states have refused to sign to give negative security assurances on this. Do you view any foreseeable change of posture in this? Thank you.
I think nuclear weapon-free zones can be important, and especially in where they exist in kind of another layer of assurance and commitment that states won't get nuclear weapons. And I think that the U.S. in particular could and should do more to encourage those, and where the U.S. has been resistant in the past, sometimes it's because of transit, that our nuclear forces operate globally and they don't want to constrain those. And I would think over time, if the shift in emphasis is like we've talked about here in the NPR, then the U.S. would be more cooperative with the operation of nuclear weapon free zones. The zones that are kind of natural have more or less been agreed. In other words, we're now into regions, the zones that are left have nuclear weapons, and so I think. And so the question is, that's where it gets harder, South Asia, Middle East, and there I think, it won't just be the U.S. that would be the obstacles.
Other questions? Well, if not, George... is there one back here? I'm sorry, I missed a hand. I'm sorry.
I'm Corinne Lane from Le Monde. Could you come back a little bit on the sole purpose discussion? What about the states with biological or chemical weapons, and how is that different from the Bush administration nuclear posture review? Thank you.
Good question.
Regarding the question of chemical and biological weapons, how they formulate that will have to be seen. I think almost everyone that I've talked to and who works on this understands that chemical weapons are not of parity with nuclear, that we should actually speak of them in that way. That there are a bunch of reasons why kind of somehow suggesting that nuclear weapons would be warranted or necessary to deal with chemical weapons is just not a good idea. Biological is trickier, where there are lots of people that say it may be the case today that there are not biological weapon threats of a probability and scale that would justify or require using nuclear weapons, but there could be tomorrow, and so you want to leave space open for that. I think that's one of the reasons why declaring that the sole purpose of U.S. nuclear weapons would be to deter use of nuclear weapons, that there was some resistance to that, saying, well, but a biological threat could emerge that would be of such a scale that you want to leave that option open. So I think that's part. But chemical, I think, kind of...
George, just to make that question more complicated, how about in response to a cyber threat? Supposing an overwhelming cyber attack that brought down power grids, financial institutions, so forth, could it be a useful deterrent?
And this is something in other writings and conversations I've been trying to provoke people about. Let me give you multiple answers. On one level, which is ironic, up until very recently, the Strategic Command, which was in charge of U.S. nuclear weapons, was also in charge of cyber defense and deterrence. So when you talk to General Cartwright, who's now the Vice Chief for the Joint Chiefs, he was the head of Strategic Command, you say, what do you worry about? He says, I spend 90% of my time worrying about cyber. But this is the guy in charge of the nuclear weapons. And I said, well, that's kind of funny because you got this toolkit which has nuclear weapons in it, and the thing you're worried about is cyber, which is like taking a sledgehammer, to a microchip in a sense. And he said, right. Another example. Estonia was shut down for a week by a cyber attack. Whether that the Russian state was involved or not is an interesting question. Under NATO's Article 5, it requires all NATO members to come to the assistance of a state under armed attack. Is a cyber attack an armed attack? It could it shut down a state, it could shut down your hospitals and so on, but is it an armed
attack? It can do a lot more than chemical in many cases.
So we haven't adapted... Right. We, meaning the U.S. and the world, haven't adapted to these kind of new threats. My own argument would be it's hard to conceive of, from a long-term political psychological standpoint, using nuclear weapons in response to a cyber attack. I think that the loss to power and moral standing for doing that would be severe, just because the world, the consequences and the imagination... It just doesn't match.
On the other hand, some people believe that a cyber attack would be a prelude to a nuclear attack if it came from the state, that you would shut down the country's ability to respond.
Right. And this is all like this brave new world, I think, that hasn't been adapted to at all. And since the United States, for example, has cyber capabilities, do you want to get in the game of saying, oh, we'll use nuclear weapons to deter cyber attacks, because then the rest of the world looks up and says, yeah, but you guys have really good cyber capabilities, therefore we need nuclear weapons. And so it, I think that one's very tricky. But you had another part of the, I don't want to delay, but that. Oh, yeah. The Bush administration had, and you can see this also in the Schlesinger-Perry Congressional Committee on the Strategic Posture. Broader. I mean, it talked about chemical and biological, so it left that gamut open. And then it talks about using nuclear posture to dissuade countries from trying to compete with the United States. That meant China. So you have to keep a posture big enough to make the Chinese decide they can't try to build up to keep you. And then it left open some conventional contingencies as well. So in a sense, it excluded very little, even though it was kind of pointing more at nuclear biology. It wasn't clean. It left a lot of ambiguity, I think.
Any other questions? Well, if not, George, thank you for this paper and for the discussion. And we look forward to hearing from you over the next couple of weeks, which should be a pretty interesting period.